My name is Katie Kelson. I'm the solicitor in charge of care and protection at Legal Aid New South Wales. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I am on, the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to elders past and present. I also acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from which you are listening today. Today, I am joined by Annette Ryan. Annette is one of our incredibly experienced care lawyers who works at our Parramatta Legal Aid office, representing both parents and children in the Children's Court. Annette, welcome, and thank you for joining me to talk about assessment applications and expert reports. We probably refer to these types of reports as assessment applications, assessment reports, clinic reports, Children's Court clinic reports. Annette, when we're talking about these reports, what are we talking about?
So these reports are sort of an independent report we're able to get from the Children's Court Clinic, which is a body set up at the Children's Court. And these reports are done by lots of different people. They could be social workers, they could be psychologists. If you're lucky, you could get a psychiatrist. And they will look into the issues that have come up before the court that have really led to this child or these children being removed from a parent and whether those issues can be dealt with, and if so, how. They're kind of like a family report, but they're not there in every children's court matter the way that you would find in a family law matter. So for people who've been doing lots of family law, they expect to have these reports in every matter. You won't have that in a children's court case. You have to make a specific application for these orders, and then you'll be allocated the clinician from the children's court clinic itself.
So just picking up on what you've just said, it's not automatic, is it, that there's a clinic report ordered, much like, well, which is different to the family court. So talking about that particular point, how does one go about making an application for a clinic assessment?
Sure. So making an application, as with any court, there's always a form. So there's a form that the court has put together that's actually quite helpful in that it sets out a lot of the issues that you would traditionally want to be looking at in a clinic application. And it gives you some guidance about the types of things you might want to ask the clinician in your particular matter to look at. That doesn't mean, for example, that you can't add your own issues that you want to be addressed. So don't feel that it has to be a ticker box and nothing more. If you've got specific issues that you want a clinician to look at, you can then add those to a form when you're making your application. But it's simply a matter of making the application to the court, filling out a formal application form that gets filed with the court, and then all of the parties have an opportunity to comment on that about whether they agree to the application, whether there might be some amendments that they seek to the application you're making, and whether it's appropriate in the first place for the order to be made.
And just to clarify, who can make an application for a clinic assessment?
Anyone who's a party to the proceedings. So often the applications will come from the secretary, where they say, for example, that they need some independent evidence or some more assessment about a parenting capacity aspect for a parent. Alternatively, they come from the parent's legal representative themselves. The parent's legal representative might think that, for example, they want some independent evidence, particularly independent of the caseworker's own assessment of their client, and they want that evidence before the court. Lastly, it could be a child's representative, whether that's an independent legal representative or the direct legal representative with a child instructing their lawyer to make the application, who says that that independent evidence would be really important before the magistrate can make a decision.
So let's dig into the details a little bit more. So we've talked about the fact that there's going to be an application filed. It's something that can be filed by anybody, any party to the proceedings. So when you're actually filling that form out and you're indicating to the court what orders you're going to seek, what are the sort of options that you have as the person making the application as to what that assessment might look like?
In terms of options, I mean, the form can be relatively prescriptive in terms of what you'd be looking at. They'll ask you for a description about why it is that you're seeking this application order, or sorry, the order be made. They'll have some sort of suggested terms that you might want to have in there about the types of things to be assessed. One of my things that I'm always looking for in an application is the way that it's worded. And that's whether I'm the person drafting it or the person who's thinking about whether I want to advise my client to consent to that order. If you've got an application, for example, that's been drafted by a caseworker, you might be looking at it thinking, well, I don't want it to say, talk about or look at my client's drug problem. I want the clinician to look at my client's alleged drug problem. And that can become a really important issue because there's no guarantee, for example, that your client agrees that they have a drug issue. You don't want to paint a picture for the clinician that they are looking for something specific or to point them in a particular direction that might have some level of bias in it for your client if that's what you're looking at.
I think that's a really important point, particularly for those of you listening that are going to be representing parents, is to have a really close look at what's been drafted and to make sure that it actually reflects the current situation, as Annette said, indicating in an assessment application that, you know, or confirming that a client has a drug problem is potentially a real problem moving forward. So a really hot tip there, Annette, about really making sure you look at the detail. So Annette, talk us through who can actually be assessed as part of this process. Children, parents, other people, are those the types of things you have to really turn your mind to carefully when you're looking at these applications?
Yeah, so commonly you're probably looking at the most common people to be assessed, you'd probably be looking at parents, proposed carers and children. So with parents, it might be, for example, that whether it's the department or yourself is wanting some information that's not able to be obtained elsewhere about this parent's parenting capacity. With kids, it might be more that they're looking at those relationships between the parent and the child. So looking at things like attachment, looking at how the child generally relates to the parent who is seeking to care for them on a long-term basis or to have them restored to their care. Another person who could be being assessed is a proposed carer. For example, you might have an aunt who, for whatever reason, the department has indicated they're not prepared to assess as a long-term carer. And so you're asking for the court clinician to assess that person to have some evidence before the court about whether they might be an appropriate long-term carer for these children.
So that again is a really good tip because, and you have to really think through the case that your client is running, don't you? Because if your client perhaps is going to be assessed, but really your client's second preference is for somebody else to be the person that looks after a child or children, then it might be really important to try and include that person in an assessment, won't it?
Absolutely. And that's really important in the sense that sometimes as a parent's lawyer, you're running your primary case, but you're also thinking about what your backup case might be in case that primary case fails. Yeah. So if you have, for example, a primary case of your client seeking restoration, but you also want to have some evidence about an aunt who you say would be an appropriate carer, you might want to think about whether that person also needs to be assessed as part of the Children's Court Clinic assessment. If you don't have that person assessed in that initial stage, you might find yourself in some difficulty trying to make a second application down the track to have that person assessed if your own client is no longer a viable option.
And that's because that usually it's the case that there is some delay when you're making an assessment application, isn't there, in terms of availability to prepare the report? And certainly when we're talking about proceedings in the Children's Court, we're always mindful of trying to resolve proceedings as quickly as possible. So as Annette said, if you're going to try and make a second application, well, you might have a lot of opposition to that second time round. So Annette, when we're thinking through the persons that might participate in this assessment, how does that work in terms of their consent?
So when it comes to consent, there's a couple of people we need to be thinking about. Firstly, when it comes to the adults, they need to consent to the process of being assessed. So if say, for example, you have a mother who is adamant that she doesn't want to participate in a process, it doesn't stop the court from making the order. But I would question the utility of making the order if you have a client who is absolutely not going to participate in the process. With children, it's a little bit different. The person who needs to consent for a child to be presented for that assessment is the person who has parental responsibility for that child. Now, by the time we get to a clinic assessment, in all likelihood, that is probably going to be the department. But there are situations where you might have a child who is still living with a parent or perhaps has been under some other form of parental responsibility, be that to a relative or a shared parental responsibility order, where that parental responsibility order dictates who needs to consent on behalf of that child in terms of the assessment.
So, Annette, do you think that there are circumstances where when you're representing a parent, perhaps the application's made by the lawyer for the secretary or for the child or by the child representative, can you think of circumstances where you might be advising your client that they should participate or advising your client that they shouldn't participate? What are you sort of turning your mind to when you're giving that advice?
Oh, absolutely. There's times where they should or they shouldn't. You could have a case, for example, where your client has had an excellent relationship with the caseworker and all signs are pointing towards restoration, and indeed maybe a document has been filed that says our plan is for restoration. The last thing you want to do is give evidence that would suggest restoration is not an appropriate outcome in that particular case. So in those circumstances, if restoration seems to be the pathway that is being quite strongly followed, that would be a situation where you would really give proper consideration to whether doing an assessment at that point in time is the most appropriate way forward. Similarly, you can have cases where the department's completely against your client and nothing will change their mind. That is a case where you might be thinking, well, it can't get any worse right now, and I need to have somebody say that my client is a viable option for this child's future life. So that might be a situation where you're saying, yes, absolutely, we need to have this assessment proceed.
Yeah, so it's really important, I think, the takeaway message there is to really think through the circumstances of your individual case and giving your client some tailored advice around that, because it's not necessarily straightforward. And particularly, I think, one of the things that people need to remember as well is that if your client is not going to consent to participate, well, how is that going to reflect upon them as well with the court? Are they going to look like they're, you know, willing to sort of come with clean hands and participate in things? Or is that really going to reflect poorly on your client? So they're the types of things to be thinking about when you're giving your client that advice. So, all right, we've gotten through all of the filing, the advice, we're coming to court, and look, there may be some parties that say yes, there may be some parties that say no, or it may be that everybody comes with the same position. But ultimately, it's up to the court to make the determination, isn't it, Annette, about whether an order is made.
That's right. You can't be lulled into a false sense of security that just because everybody at the bar table agrees this is a good idea, that you're going to have the bench on side as well. I've certainly been in cases where the bench has been most opposed to an assessment, even though every member of the bar table is urging that assessment order be made.
And why is that, Annette? Is there some legislation that we might be turning our minds to in that situation?
There is. One of the big issues for the court that you've already actually touched on, Katie, is delay. And for people coming from the family law jurisdiction, they'll laugh at the prospect that a six-week delay is something horrendous, because delays in the family law system are much longer than 6 weeks when it comes to the type of evidence that we're talking about getting from the Children's Court Clinic. But in the Children's Court context, 6 weeks is precious, precious time. And so there will often be a submission made, whether it's by the department or perhaps even a child's lawyer, that this is a child who simply cannot have that level of delay when it comes to making an application for a Children's Court Clinic order. And that sometimes also ties in with the timing of when you've made the application. If you've made this application, say, for example, after a finding's been made and before a care plan's been drafted, in my view, most of the time, that's probably the most appropriate time to make the Children's Court Clinic application. But on the other hand, if you're making this application on the first day of a hearing, you can absolutely expect to have some fairly robust submissions being made against you by at least one, if not more, parties about why this application wasn't brought sooner. And that's not to mention the furrowed brow you'll be met with when it comes to the bench as to why you haven't dealt with this issue in the last 6 to 9 months.
So timing is important.
Absolutely.
Very important. Now, when the court is making these decisions as well, they have to turn their minds to what the legislation says in terms of matters where it is appropriate, I guess, for these orders to be made. And one of the things that they have to think about is where evidence that is going to assist the court is going to come from, and whether a clinic report is going to give them evidence that is information available that is not available elsewhere. Is that right?
That's right. And examples of that will often come up, for example, for children who've had multiple assessments over the course of their lives, whether it's through the clinic or through some other source. We might have kids, for example, who've come from a family law context. There might be an expert's report out there already. They may have been seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or a parent might have been seeing one of those types of people, that they could be providing that evidence. So it's really about who's best able to provide the evidence. If it is available from another source, and that's specifically covered in the legislation, but if it is available from another source, that would be a submission against perhaps making the order, because there might be a more appropriate way of putting that evidence before the court.
So would it be right to say an example of that might be that if your client has a drug issue or an alcohol issue or some, well, just one of those two issues, that what you might find is that the court says to you, well, that's not evidence that I can get from a clinician. In fact, what your client needs to go off and do is do some urine analysis screens. They might need to go to rehabilitation. I don't need a clinic report to assist me with that. Is that an example that that you have seen in your practice?
Absolutely. And there can be an argument made that someone who is treating your client and who is seeing them over an extended period of time and administering tests of their own might be a more appropriate source of that information. The counter argument to that is about independence. The difficulty you may have, for example, with a treater, be that for a drug and alcohol problem or indeed a mental health issue, is that sometimes that treater has been engaged with a client for so long that they start potentially becoming an advocate for the client. And that's not something that will assist the court when it comes to making a decision that's in the best interests of children.
And the difference with a treater as well is that they don't have access to all of the same material that a clinician is going to have access to, are they, in terms of court documents? And they might just simply be basing what their conclusions are based on what we refer to as self-reporting.
That's absolutely right. And if you are going down the path of a treater-style report, it becomes very important to ensure that you can avoid those types of criticisms, that you've provided a full scope of the information to that treater so that their report is, as best it can be, something that gives a proper picture of this person when they're putting it before the court. Otherwise, they're simply going to be criticised when it comes to time for cross-examination.
So, Annette, can you think of a case that you might have had in your practice where you have seen an order be made by the court and tell us about the circumstances of that case?
Sure. So I think one case that sticks out for me, and it's a scenario that comes up, unfortunately, quite frequently, are kids, particularly young mothers, who are often in the care of the minister themselves. So we're talking about the 15, 16-year-old mum who's been under the parental responsibility of the minister possibly for much of her life, who falls pregnant, and once that child is born, they're removed by the department. The difficulty we often have with those clients is that they've been under the scrutiny of the minister for much of their young life. So the minister has bucket loads of information about what's been going on for them. If they're a teenage mum who's been in some difficult placement options, whether that's, for example, group homes or some fractious relationships with family members, all of that information is coming up as risk of harm reports that look quite bad for our client. Having a report done in those circumstances can be a really helpful tool. It takes the matter away from the department, away from a caseworker who's been managing this young person for much of their life, and gives them an opportunity to speak to someone independent who can assess them based on how they're presenting now without all of that backdrop of what they've been doing for the last few years whilst in care. And they can try and separate it perhaps a bit more successfully than a caseworker who's been working with that young mum would be able to do.
And it meets the test, doesn't it, in the legislation of being able to say, well, we can't get this information elsewhere, can we? We can't get this evidence because this is a young mum and probably the first opportunity to parent. And so it's a really great opportunity for the clinic to sort of look at their parenting capacity and assist the court to work out what that might look like for that child in the future.
Absolutely. And young mums are really a difficult thing when it comes before the children's court because they may not have had the best parenting themselves, particularly if they've been what is unfortunately a victim of circumstance, being moved around from one placement to another. They don't have necessarily that role modelling that you would like to think someone who is entering into parenthood would have had. So being able to have an independent report where someone looks at them as a young mum, not a kid in care, can be a really important process.
Mm. So let's think of the opposite scenario. Can you think of a matter that you have been involved in where the order has not been made, and tell us about why the order wasn't made?
I think one that's come up for me, particularly as a child's representative, is when an application for an assessment would cause distress to a child. So it's not necessarily that the order's not being made, but that perhaps the order's not including an assessment of the child. You may have, for example, parents coming wanting to have their parenting capacity assessed, I will often have kids who have been through so much and seen so many people, the last thing they need is being put through another assessment process. And so those are matters where I might be considering whether that issue of distress to the child is such that really an assessment shouldn't be undertaken of the child, but perhaps could only be limited to the parent themselves.
Mm, that's a really good example and something for us all to keep in mind in terms of making these applications when we're acting for parents, that you might have a child representative that's very concerned about the impact on the child and may argue against it. So, all right, just say we do get the order. What happens from there? It's all about the person that makes the application from that point, isn't it? There's a bit of work to be done.
It is. If you've made that application, you better have cleared your diary because you've got some administrative tasks to attend to and relatively quickly. In terms of getting everything together, you will need to be getting the bundle of documents through to the clinic within 7 days of the order being made. And can I say that can be quite a large bundle of documents that needs to be provided. The clinic doesn't want just one copy. They want 2 copies. They want physical copies. Sometimes they want electronic copies. It's really something you need to be liaising with the clinic about as to what they need, but certainly be prepared to have them have those 2 copies of the documents ready so that they can retain one in the clinic and send one out to their clinician. And on that issue of documents, the actual application itself will have set out the documents that you need to send. It's really important when you're having your order made that you've got all of that set out properly and it's ready to go at the time the order is made. A real delay in clinic applications that is often lamented by the Children's Court Clinic is the unavailability of documents or delay in documents, particularly when it comes to subpoenaed documents. If you're making a clinic application, you want to make sure on the day that order is made that you have already got copies of all of the clinic material that you need to provide to the Children's Court Clinic so that they can start their process of setting up interviews with these parties.
If we just delve into that a little bit further, that means with subpoena material, doesn't it, Annette, that just saying that you'll provide the clinic subpoena material is not going to cut it, because 7 days to try and figure out with the parties which documents should go from the subpoena material is not going to work, is it? So make sure that at the time that you're circulating that assessment application, you have worked out with the parties exactly what documents need to go to the Children's Court Clinic. Don't try and fit it in within that 7-day period. That's a rookie mistake that I think we've all made.
Absolutely. And what you might also want to think about is when you think about that subpoena material, does it all need to go? We've all faced the boxes that you can uncover when you go to inspect material. Does a clinician really need to be greeted with boxes and boxes and boxes of material? Certainly there will be times where you do need to provide them with a lot because it's about context, but do they need every single document that has ever been produced in relation to this family? The answer is probably not.
And I think, you know, as lawyers, we have an obligation to make sure that we're only providing the absolute important documents to the clinic. We have to make sure that we've done our job and made their life a bit easier, because I'm sure if the clinic was here, they would say to us, the answer is absolutely not. We do not need to see every document. We just need to see the documents that are relevant. So make sure you make their life a bit easier by doing that before they get the piles and piles of documents you're going to send to them. So we're going to move on from clinic reports, and we're just going to talk about expert reports, which fall outside, I guess, of the remit of the Children's Court Clinic. Annette, can you talk to us a little bit about those? When would you think it was appropriate to consider an expert report as opposed to a report that was obtained from the Children's Court Clinic?
Yeah, an expert's report, they're not always sought in Children's Court matters, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be sought. An expert's report that you're seeking outside the realm of the clinic is really a recognition that the issues in your case warrant some particular level of expertise. And that can come up, for example, in quite a serious mental health issue where you might want a guarantee of a psychiatrist providing a report in relation to those mental health issues. It could come up in sexual abuse matters where you need someone whose experience is in sexual abuse matters and the risk of, for example, relapse of somebody who has been convicted of a sex offence. in terms of whether they are an appropriate carer for a child, you would want that specific level of expertise. A big one for me is non-accidental injuries. It's the intersection of medical evidence and care and protection evidence that we're looking at in those types of reports. And so you really need to have something before the court about what the injury is. And ideally, we're looking for information and evidence about what was the likely cause of the injury. You're looking at the different scenarios that have been presented by an alleged perpetrator of that injury, trying to work out once and for all, if it's at all possible, how this injury came to be and how we're going to make sure that this child isn't at risk in the future. Because the difficult thing we have in those types of cases is sometimes we'll never know who did it or how it happened. It then becomes about how do we manage the risk.
So Annette, in those types of matters that you're describing where it's not going to be appropriate to get a report from the clinic, I think probably it's important to try and work through those issues quite early in the piece. And I would think that you would need to go about doing that by raising that issue with the parties pretty early on in the proceedings, because one of the things to keep in mind is that when you get a clinic report, then obviously there's not a cost attached with that. But there is going to be one if you're looking for an expert outside of the clinic. So thinking through that the other parties might need to consider their positions about how they might fund this report, whether DCJ want to contribute some, if you're in receipt of a grant of legal aid, whether you might need to consider applying for some funding there. They're all the types of things that you need to be thinking about quite early in the piece. And then you're thinking about the identity of the expert. Have you got any advice about how to go about considering the most appropriate person to prepare a report?
Yeah, I think it's really about making sure that the expert you're appointing is an expert who fits the particular circumstances of your case. There's no point in getting a run-of-the-mill psychologist to prepare a report if what you really need is someone who can provide expert advice about risk of sexual abuse. You want to have somebody who is accredited in that particular area to be able to provide an expert's report. And it really is a conversation amongst the lawyers about who is appropriate, who is available, how much they cost, because that's the unfortunate reality. We are talking about people having to pay for a report, and you might have some parties who are not prepared to pay for a report from a particular expert, but are prepared to pay for another expert. So it really is a big conversation amongst the legal practitioners, because chances are everybody is going to need to be pitching in on the finance side when it comes to funding this expert.
And you're having similar conversations with the parties, aren't you, about what documents need to go, what subpoena material might need to go, who needs to participate, what the terms of reference are going to be for that expert. Those are all the same conversations that you should be having, aren't they?
Absolutely. They're the same sorts of conversations you're having with a clinician's report in terms of documents and those sorts of things. Terms of reference plays a bit more of a role when you're appointing the expert, because you're not confined by an application form. So there's a little more scope to be able to personalise what the expert is looking at for this particular matter. And that can be a really helpful thing, particularly in those cases that have a very specific issue that needs to be addressed.
So the last category of report that I wanted to touch on is when you might consider yourself, if you're acting for a mum or a dad, or even if you're acting for anybody else, when you might go and try and get a report yourself. When would you think that that would be an appropriate thing to do?
Getting your own expert's report, sometimes that can be you're getting it because you've tried to get a clinic report and you've been shot down. You've made your application and you've been found, you got found against, essentially. The magistrate decided they weren't going to make the order for you to have a clinic report. So that might be a case where you realise there's still a real hole in your client's case for restoration. It might be, for example, that your client has a mental health issue that really needs to have evidence about how that mental health issue has been addressed. It might be that your client has had some drug problems that you need a report from a drug and alcohol counsellor about how that issue has been addressed. So those are the types of matters that really you need to be filling the gaps in the evidence when it comes to final hearing to make sure that there's proper expert evidence before the court about the real issues in your client's case.
Okay. And so if you did think that that was an important thing for you to do to make sure you were running your client's case, is there anything in particular that practitioners need to be mindful of in terms of going and doing that?
I think one thing that we need to always remember is that there's not a bar on you doing it. Just because you didn't get a clinic order made doesn't mean you can't fill that gap with your own expert evidence. You can go and get that evidence from your own expert. You will be restricted in the sense of time frames. The court's not going to give you an unlimited amount of time to be able to get that report, but you are going to be able to get it if you can file it within the timeframes imposed by the court for that evidence as an affidavit, in the same way that you would file an affidavit for your own client. The other thing you need to remember is that you can provide copies of court documents to that expert so that they can properly prepare a report. And that's really important, coming back to the issue that we talked about earlier, where you don't want a treater preparing a report with only half the story.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, I think that covers off on all of the various types of reports that we might see floating around in the children's court. Have you got any final words of wisdom or hot tips for lawyers that might just be starting out in care and protection in terms of any of the types of reports that they might be working with or trying to obtain?
I think my two biggest ones would be, firstly, whenever you're faced with an application for an assessment order or an expert's report, really think about it critically in terms of, is this going to help my client? Or if it's not, is there something I need to change about the actual terms of reference that are going to be looked at? Don't think just because you're presented with an application that you don't have a role to play in what that eventual order looks like for your client. And don't be afraid to say that you won't participate if it's not amended to be an appropriately balanced application or an order for that expert. Secondly, I'd say don't underestimate how important it is to talk to your colleagues about the various experts that are out there who could be preparing reports in your matter. There is something really invaluable about hearing a first-hand account of having seen a report from an expert, or from having seen that expert bear or come under the test of cross-examination in terms of having to answer to their report. It can really inform whether you feel that that might be an appropriate expert for your particular matter.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Annette. That rounds us out in terms of this podcast. So thank you so much for listening, and thanks, Annette, for joining us.
Thank you.